I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I happened to be in Dallas last month, the same weekend that Burnaby-born Michael Bublé was playing there. He drew a sold-out crowd at the arena there, and the reviews the next day were tremendous, saying things like he's at the apex of his popularity and, quote, not lacking in the pipes department. He was compared to Tony Bennett in another review. It's been a long road for Bublé that began 20 years ago when the 18-year-old singer entered a talent contest put on by my guest now, Beverly Delich. At a nightclub on Broadway, he got up and sang, impressed a lot of people, but was disqualified. He was too young to even be in the club. But the woman who had to break the news that he was ineligible ended up fostering his talent and managing him, and did she take him places. She recounts all of that in her new memoir, Come Fly With Me, Michael Bublé's Rise to Stardom. In the book, Ms. Delich talks about the family that Bublé had around him, the love and support that helped him get noticed in this town. She talks about what it was like managing Bublé and booking gigs at clubs, conventions, and parties, as well as theatrical productions. There are also stories about the less-than-successful moments in his young career, when there were people who didn't know what to make of a kid who sounded like Frank Sinatra. I'll get Beverly to tell us about this book that also talks about her own life before Bublé. That began in Montana, that included a career in interior design, a couple of marriages, a couple of kids, managing a talent agency, breast cancer, and coordinating entertainment at the Pacific National Exhibition, where Bublé began getting noticed. This book is published by Douglas N. McIntyre and was written with the Vancouver Sun columnist Shelley Frelick. There is a launch for the book at the Chapters on Robson Street. That's Wednesday, the 20th of November at 7 p.m. Beverly Delich will be signing copies of the book then. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Beverly Delich. Ms. Delich, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
So even early on, Michael and his mom, Amber, would tell you, because of the life you've had, the storied life that you've had, that you ought to write a book, and so you have.
And so I have. Yes, I wanted to write it when I was around even in my 30s, because I had so many various experiences in my life. And then, of course, when I met Michael, they used to always say, be sure to put this in your book, be sure to put that in your book. And so I was ready when I wrote the book.
So you were born in Montana, right?
Yes, Butte, Montana, which was a wonderful place to grow up at that time.
Yeah, and it's a lot different now, isn't it, from when you were growing up?
A lot different, yes, of course it is.
Yeah. You still have family there?
Yes, I do. Well, not in Butte, but in Great Falls. I have my younger sister and my older brother, and of course our parents died when we were very young.
Yeah. It was a different childhood. I was going to say difficult, but I mean there were difficult parts to it, but it was certainly a childhood that, I mean, you left home at an early age, didn't you?
Yes, I was actually 20-some years old. My childhood was very restrictive, and I knew that later on in life it was because my mom had, she always used to say that she was born under an unlucky star. She had a very inhibited life herself.
Yeah. And then you ended up in Vancouver how long after?
When I was 67, the year 1967,
yeah.
I was 27. I married a Canadian who lived next door to me in Montana when we were going to university there.
And then you had the career in interior design. You had a couple businesses here, and then you guys moved to Edmonton for a spell, right?
Yes, about a year and a half.
Yeah. How long until you went into, say, show business and managing? I mean, even as a kid, you were always performing in the sort, but as you said, you had this restrictive childhood that you couldn't do that sort of stuff.
But, yes. No, go ahead.
Yeah, so when was it that you started, when you got involved, say, with the P&E, or you got involved with the Platters?
Well, I think it was when I was still involved in interior design, and then I met Ray Carroll. Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. I met Ray Carroll when I was working for Neon Products after I returned from Edmonton, and of course Ray Carroll was with the Platters, and at the club we were at that night, my friend said to him, do you know Beverly sings? And then one thing led to another, and then he said to me, you should leave the decorating business and come into the entertainment business. I could help you along. And so that's what I did.
Yeah, and so you were running talent. You were cultivating talent for the P&E and for the talent contest there. But you also had contests throughout the city.
Yes, that's how they started. Ray wanted to do that. Yeah. He said, "Let's organize talent contests." Because it brought people into the clubs, because everybody loves the contest, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the first ones we did was at the Big Bamboo, and that's where I met Michael.
So when you saw him and sing, he sang well, right, even for someone who was 18?
Oh, very well. Everybody went crazy, and it wasn't just his singing, but his whole persona, the way he moved on stage, and his liveliness, and he was just adorable.
And then you had to disqualify him because I guess you have to be 21 to be in a nightclub here.
Yes.
And
yes.
He referred to you as Beverly the Bitch, right?
Beverly the Bitch. He went home and told his family, Beverly, she was a real bitch, and she disqualified me.
Could you see early on, even that night, that we would have the talent that we have today, the star that we have today?
No, I never knew what that meant, Joe. I never knew what that meant. People have said to me on an ongoing basis, How did you know? But I didn't know. I just knew that he was talented. I never knew what made it mean or stardom. I never thought about that stuff. I really didn't. I just felt he was just totally a total package.
Yeah, so he had an idea, though, of where he wanted to go. I mean, that's
yes.
what I get from the book, even at 18.
Yes.
He knew he wanted to do something more than just, say, sing at weddings and the sort.
Oh, absolutely. He was completely driven, completely.
Do you think an 18-year-old in the 1990s singing Sinatra, nowadays it seems, I mean, with the music competition programs on television, it seems natural. But at the time, it seemed kind of odd, didn't it?
Well, it did, and also, but his voice totally suited that genre, and at the time, it was difficult because I remember my daughter calling me one morning before I even met Michael and saying, oh, there's this new guy that you'll just love listening to. His name is Harry Connick Jr., and he sings all the songs from your era. Mm. And so that was a tough thing for us because we had Harry Connick Jr. out there besides Sinatra. So that was one of the reasons that, you know, it was difficult for us.
And so he participates in a couple of contests. I mean, you mentioned the one at the Big Bamboo, and then there was one in New Westminster to qualify for the P&E, which he didn't win.
No, he didn't.
But you still brought him along and gave him, I guess, a pass to...
I did, yeah. Because he was really great to watch and to listen to, and I wanted to invite him. And that's one of the prerogatives I had, being the coordinator of that contest.
And I was wondering, while I was reading that in the book, whatever happened to the winners?
Well, and nothing that I know of. Mm. The winners of any of the, except for Carly Rae Jepsen, who used to be in my kids' talent search, so you know how many years ago that was.
Yeah, yeah.
She, that was 6 to 12-year-olds. She was, I remember her competing in the kids' talent search then, and she was really adorable.
Yeah.
I don't know of anybody else that actually did anything more.
Yeah, yeah. One wonders, you know, what happened to...
Oh, Alana Morissette from
really?
Eastern Canada.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So after he starts winning these contests and he picks you to be his manager, do you have a sense of why he liked you and why he chose you?
Well, when we went to the International Youth Talent Search in Memphis, we were coming home on the plane, which he didn't win, of course, and he said to me, why don't you be my manager? And that's why I entitled that chapter 15% of Nothing, and I'll give you 15% of everything I make. And I said, Michael, why do you think you need a manager, and what's 15% of nothing? And he laughed, and that's when he said to me, because it's a tough role, because you're very professional, yet you're very personable, and people take you seriously. That's what he said.
Yeah, and his mom tells you that she saw a different side to Michael from the way he treated you.
Yes, she said that Michael treated me with more respect than anybody she had ever known. And he just always respected me and spoke highly of me.
Yeah. We see a different side of him, though, in this book, the side backstage, behind the curtain, if you will. But he's still the same sort of guy that we see on TV now, right? I mean, he's affable and personable and all that.
Very much so, very much so. He still has the passion, and he still is very kind to people. And, yes, he's still the same. That is, has never changed. The only thing I had changed, the only thing had, that had changed would be his maturity and how he is on stage now.
You think he's a better singer today than he was, say, at 18?
No doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, and what do you think that is? Is it practice or the people that he had around him that sort of developed that, do you think? Or?
Definitely practice. Yeah. Definitely practice, yes. And working with David Foster, without a doubt.
Now, another great lesson in this book, Come Fly With Me, is how you handle talent and how to handle, say, a star like or a client like him. As a manager, you didn't just do what he wanted, but you did what you thought was best, and even though at times he may have thought you were ignoring him.
Exactly. Well, you know what I used to tell him that just came from within myself, that I said you have to treat the business as a person. If whatever we do isn't good for that person, then we can't do it, no matter what it means. If there's any red flags at all, we would never do those things. And he learned to understand that very well.
Yeah. We do see a different side, though, in terms of, backstage, off camera, if you will. Is he temperamental at all, or?
Yes, he is. Yeah. Yes, he's temperamental. He always was.
Yeah, and where do you think that was? Was that insecurity, or was that just a perfectionism, or is that just his culture?
Well, I think it's a little bit of everything. It's yes, his background, definitely. He has that temper, and I think that his family might have had a little bit of that in them as well, and because that's the way they reacted to things. Well, very reactionary, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything, and the fact that he's a perfectionist, and he always wanted more, and he didn't always just want to be a smooth talker.
It was fascinating to see, like, if you would go to a party, say, in Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
that he thought of how you got there, even, and how it looked driving in, say, your old car or something. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Never bothered me because, of course, I understood all of that was going on, right, but not for him. He used to say, I can't believe we're going to Tom Wally's party in our car, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I say, Michael, don't even worry about that stuff.
Yeah. You drive a pretty good car now, right?
I do?
Yeah.
Yes, I have the Mercedes he gave me.
Yeah, that's in the book. And it's a beautiful chapter, a beautiful episode in the book about how you got that from,
yes.
And his family presents that to you, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago, is that right?
In 2008, it was a really fun time, yes.
Yeah. The material that he did, sort of early on, I remember listening to him on the radio on say, David Berner's program or Jack Cullen, when Cullen would play him. The material was heavy on Sinatra, Louis Prima, and
yes.
the sort. That's the stuff he listened to? I mean, he listened to other stuff, too.
You know what? He loved Louis Prima.
Yeah.
I remember Louis Prima was his favorite, and Bobby Darin, he loved Bobby Darin. Yes, and Louis Prima, he loved him.
So was that the kind of music that he always wanted to do, or?
Always, no matter when I ever got into the car even, he would say to me, which was, as I wrote in the book, full of papers and bottles and all that kind of stuff, it was too funny,
yeah.
plastic bottles, Bev, listen to this, what do you think of this? Oh my God, listen to this. Look at this. This is this person when they were younger. Well, look at this. Look at Sinatra when he was younger. Always, always, always.
Yeah, and so did you, say, encourage him to do other material?
No, I never encouraged him to do anything.
Yeah. So he played clubs and did some stage work here for the Arts Club in Vancouver, and was that around the time that you first called Bruce Allen?
He did the Red Rock Diner,
mm-hmm.
and Bruce Allen was in the audience.
And
a friend said to me, Bruce Allen is in the audience. And I said, really? And that was where I wrote in the book that very next day I called. And when someone answered, I just said, is he in? I mean, whoever put you, it was too funny.
Yeah.
And when Bruce, when he said to me, just a second, who are you?
Yeah.
And how do you spell your name? Because I never want to forget this conversation. Because I said, he said, what do you want? And I said, a record deal, management and a record deal, just like that.
Yeah. But he, did he sign him right away after that, or?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. He was very nice and said that he was adorable and he had a good voice, but he didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah. And you got that a lot over
there. Yes, we got that a lot from everybody. Even David Foster said, but I don't know what to do with him.
Yeah.
And Michael said, if you don't know, who would know?
And so I guess the Mulrooney wedding, I remember reading about that, that seemed to take him into a different stratosphere altogether, because he got noticed. That's where he met Foster for the first time, right?
Yes, and Brian Mulrooney loved him and actually put a headlock on him with his hand, his arm, and said, do something with this kid. And that's when David said, I don't know what to do with him.
And Foster tells you that you need $450,000 to make a record.
Yes.
And you met Paul Anka. He comes off, Paul Anka, by the way, comes off very well in the book. He's just,
yes, well, you know, he's a wonderful man, very much a consummate entertainer and ultimate host.
Just a class act, too, eh?
Class act.
Yeah. And so he helps get the money to fund this, right?
He helps get the money.
Yeah. Now, that CD, the first CD, Michael, well, he'd done CDs in Vancouver, but I guess that was the first big CD that he did.
Yes.
He did two records on that I quite liked, How Do You Mend a Broken Heart and Kissing a Fool.
Those are two of my favorites as well.
Yeah, and so whose idea was it to do, say, not just Sinatra stuff on that album?
Well, we sat and did that brainstorming at Paul Anka's house, and I remember all of the songs coming out. There was dozens of them. How about this, how about that, and at one point when David even asked me, and I was so flattered, and, you know, we all just brainstormed and threw all of these songs out, and David said, Michael said to David, you know, David, I don't want to do just Sinatra, I'm not Sinatra, and David said in the end, you have to do a couple of Sinatra songs, because that's really, you know, this is his genre. And so we did the brainstorming, but ultimately the choices were theirs, David, Paul, and Michaels, and they narrowed it down. It was really a tough thing to do, to narrow it down.
Yeah, but it's a great album in the sense that you get sort of the range of his talent,
yes,
as a singer.
It's perfect. I think that was just really representative of him.
Yeah, well, was that when you felt that you and Michael were growing apart?
No, never felt that.
No?
No, not until we came home and it was real.
Mm. And then he'd be playing around the world, and you'd be left here, right?
Well, that's right, because he was behind a big machine now.
Yeah.
Just a big machine who had to take him where he needed to go, and I knew that, although it was very bittersweet.
Yeah. You'd interviewed managers,
yes,
because you knew that you'd have to hand him off sooner or later.
Yes.
He liked Marty Ehrlichman, who manages Barbra Streisand, but you didn't think he was right.
I didn't think he was the right one. I always wanted Bruce. I just knew that Bruce was the person for Michael. I knew his personality. I knew what he was like. And I always wanted Bruce Allen. Yes, I did.
And what's he like? Because, I mean, he comes off, he comes across as, you know, a bit of a jerk on the radio and the sort. But in terms of managing talent, I mean, he's the best that we have in this town, right?
He is the best. And, you know, he's very bombastic and very very outspoken, as we know, and I can't tell you how many people said to me, I can't believe you picked Bruce Allen, and I said, watch and see, right?
Yeah.
But the thing I loved about him was his professionalism. I always said if I came back into this business again in another life, I'd like to be a Bruce Allen, yeah, because there's nothing I don't like about Bruce Allen. Honestly, I don't. When it comes to business, he's the best. He's the best in everywhere I ever know.
Yeah.
That's Bruce.
Yeah, people will pick up this book, doubtless to want to know what it was like to be with Michael and the sort, and what he's like. I mean, in the time that you guys were making that first album in L.A., you lived with him, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What was that like? Were there babes hanging around all the time in the sort?
Never.
No.
No, that was not who he was. And as I put it in the book, I was sure when we went down that he would have liked to just be on his own and everything, but I just always knew that we weren't finished, right? I mean, and why wouldn't I go? Mm. I needed to be there. I always felt that, and I'm glad I did, because it worked out for the better. And, you know, Bruce laughed when he actually came into our apartment and said, Jesus, you guys really do live together. But he always smiled about it, right? Because the whole story is very unique. I wasn't a manager. I was 53 years old. I had a relationship with him that was beyond that. He was like a son to me.
Yeah. And so you guys still talk?
Yes, we do. Not as often, but we do. And he sent me a picture of his new baby and said the little dude had so much hair, and they were taking him home that day. And I always write to him on his birthday to wish him a happy birthday, but I know he's extremely busy.
Yeah. He's still the same person. Do you think he's happy now?
Oh, I think he's really happy now. He found everything he wanted.
Yeah, he's a husband and a dad, right?
Yes, and she's wonderful. I have spent time with her when we've gone for lunch or coffee, and she's just wonderful for him.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there were a number of breakups before he found
yes.
his wife, and you were there for that. You were there
yes,
with Debbie.
All of it.
Debbie Tamus, the local actress
yes.
here. I mean, I saw her on stage, by the way, in something at the Arts Club.
She's amazing. How
just
she's
gorgeous. You know,
she's gorgeous and lovely.
Yeah. And then were you there for the Emily Blunt breakup and all that?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was devastated by all of it.
Was there, say, pressure on you to say, put some of the gossipy stuff in this book?
Oh, yes. You'll notice that I didn't put any gossipy stuff in there.
Yeah, it's very tasteful.
Yes, because I never wanted anything to affect Michael's career, his family. I mean, who needs that? No one.
And you're close to the family still, right?
No, not as much.
No?
No.
What I was quite surprised with was how much they supported him in all of his endeavors. I mean, the thousands of dollars they spent on
yes.
CDs and the sort, making
well,
those.
They knew that's what he wanted.
Yeah.
And, you know, the one thing I never put in the book, and I kind of think, I wondered why I didn't put that little part in, was, and I think Michael talked about it in an interview he had done, in one of the books he had written, that he wanted to quit. And I said, he said, I'm going to go to a trade school, and I'll take up a trade. And I said to him, Michael, how long will it be before you're sitting there saying, watching other people who are making it, and you will say to yourself, why didn't I hang in there? I said, Michael, what will it get you to take on a trade and go out there and start working? This is who you are. And I remember I said, let's give it one more year. And I didn't put that in my book, but we did, and he did. And that's where it went.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's the lesson here? I mean, if you do have talent, I mean, it's to pursue it, right?
Well, yes. You know, unfortunately, though, Joe, a lot of people feel they have that talented. They have that talent, and they want to go out and follow their dream. And it doesn't always happen. But if you have something inside, like the passion that Michael had, and you really feel this is your thing, then you should go for it. And as I mentioned in one of the comments, that attitude is paramount, your attitude toward your craft. Like Michael was always a gentleman when it came to working with anyone, and you can never go out there being smug and thinking that you're the cat's meow, because you're not.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter who, like for myself, it doesn't matter who comes to me and says, could you get me out there? If I don't have what the people out there want, it never happens. They have to, the people like David Foster and Warner, they have to want a Michael Bublé, or it'll never happen. It doesn't matter who you know.
And I'm sure people come to you all the time and asking for advice, asking you to manage them still.
It still
yeah.
goes on. Yes,
yeah.
We're a band that needs promotion, blah, blah, blah.
But a talent like Michael Bublé's, that's just once in a lifetime, isn't it?
You know, it's like the lottery. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. You've got two great kids of your own, and it's delightful to read in the book how well you guys get along and the sort.
Wonderful.
Two grandkids now, is that right?
Yes, I'm very blessed.
Yeah. You're healthy as well, right?
Yes, I am. I had that thing with the atrial fibrillation, but I'm in very good health.
Yeah. So life's looking pretty good for you, Bevy.
And I'm very happy, yes, I'm very happy.
He still calls you Bevy, does he?
Yes, he does, Bevy.
Yeah. This is such a delightful book, and it's a great story, because it's one that we've been watching for, well, damn near 20 years.
And, I know.
And it's good that a local kid made good, and to read your part in that, because, I mean, it was a pivotal part, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was, and I think it's very unique, because usually when you read about managers and acts parting, they just parted business-wise. Nobody ever talks about anything like what we went through. That's why I felt it was very unique.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on this book, and good luck with it, Beverly.
Thank you so much for your time, and I just everything about it. Thank you.
Thank you. The book is called Come Fly With Me, Michael Bublé's Rise to Stardom. It's from Douglas and McIntyre. There's a book signing at the Robson Chapters on Wednesday, the 20th of November. That's at 7 p.m. Beverly Delitz joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Lanta.